Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Audra, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, What's New in Precision Medicine. And today's activity is supported by Bristol-Myers Squibb, and we really appreciate their support of this program today. Now, we have over 110 participants on the call today, and you come from all of the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have a number of international participants from Canada, New Zealand, the Philippines, Romania, Uganda, and the United Kingdom. So it is truly a global call. And it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now I'm going to move on and introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Leonard Saltz. And Dr. Saltz is medical oncologist, executive director for clinical value and sustainability, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, professor of medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College. And Dr. Saltz will be addressing understanding precision medicine, overview of, and value of precision medicine, and how precision medicine is different from targeted treatments, and precision medicine's role in informing treatment decisions, predicting response to treatment for colon cancer. It's now my pleasure to introduce my esteemed colleague, Dr. Saltz.
Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to have a chance to talk with you today. So I'm going to try to define some terms and then explain how this applies in the area that I focus on, which is treating people with cancers of colorectal origin. When we talk about precision medicine, what we're talking about is trying to make ourselves smarter in terms of understanding what made the cancer happen, what's driving the cancer to survive, and what we can do to most effectively attack the cancer. When a cancer develops, what we've come to understand is that there are a variety of different mutations that may occur somewhere in the genes of the cancer that lead to changes in how the cell receives signals that tell it to grow and survive. And in precision medicine, what we try to do is understand the mechanism of what is driving the cancer. Is it a mutation in a gene that's sending signals to the nucleus of the cell that's telling it to keep growing? Is it some growth factor receptor that is either underexpressed or overexpressed that is driving the cancer? And how can we utilize that information to best treat the patient? When we talk about a targeted therapy, that's a term that implies that the treatment is going after a specific abnormality or target on the tumor that doesn't exist on normal cells. Now, that's virtually always a bit of an overstatement, and the way I would think about it is the target is overexpressed on the tumor in such a way that the attack is more aggressive on the cancer cells than on normal cells. But unfortunately, even our targeted therapies will often have some effect on normal cells, and that can lead to side effects. So with that sort of broad overview, let me talk about cancers of the colon and rectum. To explain the terms a little more, everybody understands that you've got a small intestine followed by a large intestine. The large intestine in an adult is typically about 6.5 feet long, and the last 6 inches before the outside world are the rectum, and the rest of the large intestine is the colon. When we have advanced or metastatic cancer from that organ, it's called colorectal cancer. And the first information that we now want in understanding the disease is to understand whether the tumor has any mutations or deficiencies in a series of proteins called mismatch repair proteins. And so if the tumor has all of the proteins, it's called mismatch repair proficient. If one or more is missing, and this is something that our pathologists work out for us with special stains on the tumor tissue, if one or more is missing, then it's mismatch repair deficient. That is really important because the small percentage of patients that have mismatch repair deficient colorectal cancer have tumors that are very, very sensitive to a newer approach to therapy called immunotherapy, where we use the drugs to stimulate the immune system to fight the cancer rather than use a more typical chemotherapy agent, which is a selective poison to try to destroy the cancer without doing too much damage to normal tissues. So mismatch repair deficient colorectal cancer, which is the less common variety, is very sensitive to immunotherapy, but immunotherapy is completely inactive in the common type or mismatch repair proficient disease. To further understand that mismatch repair proficient disease, we dive into looking at certain genes that have an impact on the effectiveness of certain therapies. And there are four genes in particular that you may hear your doctor talk to you about: KRAS, NRAS, BRAF, and HER2. These are genes that affect the availability of certain treatment options in this disease. So the RAS genes, KRAS and NRAS, KRAS and NRAS, are genes that when they're mutated, they become kind of the driver, if you will, the driver mutations that stimulate the cancer to grow and survive. There's a class of agents that block the epidermal growth factor receptor, or the EGFR, on the surface of the cell. One is called Erbitux, the other is called Vectibix, and these agents can't work if KRAS and NRAS aren't normal. So if they're mutated, we know not to use those agents. If they're not mutated, then those agents figure very much into our thinking. BRAF is a gene that, when it's mutated, drives the cancer very aggressively, but we now have specific therapies that are targeted against BRAF, and when we know that there is a specific BRAF mutation, we can use the BRAF-targeted agents as specific treatments for the cancer. Now, that will only happen in fewer than 1 in 10 patients with colorectal cancer, but for those people, it's a very important intervention, and so we need to know about it. HER2 is a growth factor receptor that has been identified on many different tumors and is a key target in treating breast cancer. But it's only more recently that we've come to understand that a small percentage of patients with colorectal cancer have an amplification of HER2, and therefore there are very specific therapies that will be totally useless in the absence of HER2 amplification, but can be very useful if that's present. So by understanding the particulars of the tumor, by getting a more precise evaluation of what is amplified, what is mutated, what is causing the cancer to grow and survive, we have the ability to more precisely target our approach to the patient. So I hope that overview is useful to you, and with that, I'm going to stop and turn it over to my colleagues.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Saltz. That was just a stellar presentation, really wonderful, giving people a lot of information about precision medicine, targeted treatments, and also about the treatment of colorectal cancer. So thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you. Thank you very much. And our next speaker is Dr. Aaron Goldberg, and Dr. Goldberg is Assistant Attending Physician, Leukemia Service, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Goldberg will be addressing the role of precision medicine in deciding the treatment for leukemia, talking with your healthcare team about precision medicine and its benefits, and guidelines for prepare for telehealth, telemedicine appointments, including technology and prepared list of questions. It is my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Goldberg.
Thank you very much for the invitation to join you today. It's a privilege to speak with you. I just wanted to echo, you know, a lot of what Dr. Salt said and speak more specifically about, you know, my particular area of expertise, which is leukemia and blood cancers, and in particular, acute myeloid leukemia. So in precision medicine, I think, is absolutely critical when we think about how to take the best care of our patients. And really what it means is we're not taking a one-size-fits-all approach. I think for so long we were treating every single patient and every, you know, the exact same way with the same treatment and not recognizing that even in a particular disease that there are different subtypes that can behave very differently and there are specific treatments that will help specific patients, you know, more than others. And so it's really a broad approach, you know, tailoring our medical treatment to the individual characteristics of the patient. And so more broadly with precision medicine, we're thinking not just about, you know, the disease, but also who is the person in front of us? You know, how old is this person? What are their other medical problems? You know, how fit are they to tolerate the different treatments? And then we zoom in and try to figure out what are the specific genes and abnormalities, just like Dr. Salt said, that are driving this particular cancer? And this is where targeted therapy comes in. Can we use a biologically targeted therapy to really hit that specific genetic change that is driving this particular person's cancer? And so I wanted to talk a little bit about how we use that in the context of acute myeloid leukemia. So AML is it's a serious blood cancer that happens in about 1% of all cancers, about 20 to 21,000 patients per year in the United States. And it's still a serious disease, but I have to say, you know, fortunately, our outcomes are getting better and better. And I think a lot of that is really due to our better understanding of the biology of the disease and the specific genetic changes that are driving these particular cancers. Our goal, if we can at all, is very much to try to cure every patient with acute myeloid leukemia. We can't do that in every single case, but we can in many cases, and we're doing better and better. The way in which we try to cure the patient really depends upon, again, the specific features of the disease, the specific features of the patient, and the specific treatments that we're going to use. So again, taking into account a lot of factors, not taking a one-size-fits-all approach. So, you know, when I see a patient with leukemia, acute myeloid leukemia, the first question always is, let's make absolutely sure we know the diagnosis. This involves working very closely with, you know, our pathology colleagues, and you'll hear, of course, from Dr. Cox about the role of the pathologist, making sure we know exactly the diagnosis, and then making sure we understand the specific features of the disease. So when we think about leukemia, this is a cancer of the blood and the bone marrow. The bone marrow is really the factory for all of our blood. It makes all the white blood cells, red blood cells, and platelets. And leukemia, in particular acute myeloid leukemia, is a disease, a cancer of those cells that are in the bone marrow, in that factory. And because those cells are abnormal, that's why the factory, the bone marrow, can't make the normal blood counts that it should. And so patients can have abnormally low or high white blood cells. They can have a weak immune system. They could have low red blood cells. They could have anemia, feel weak. They could have low platelets, be more prone to bleeding. And my goal is to try to restore a normal bone marrow for the patient, ideally to get rid of the blood cancer and to restore normal blood counts so that the patient can feel better. And the way we do that is first, again, to confirm the diagnosis, then we zoom way in, and our pathologists really are the ones that help us to do this, to look specifically, what are the specific features of this person's disease? So we look at the chromosomes, and this is chromosomes are really the packaging for our genetic material. You know, we get half of our genes from our mom, half of our genes from our dad, and they're packaged by chromosomes in a certain way. They look a certain way under the microscope. And there are characteristic chromosomal abnormalities in particular leukemias that can help in some ways us as leukemia doctors tailor our treatments for that particular person's disease. We can then zoom in even further beyond just the chromosomes, down into the individual genes. We all have about 25,000 genes in our genome, and there are some specific genes that when they're when they're mutated, are really very powerful drivers of this blood cancer leukemia. And so we sequence those genes. We use what's called the next generation DNA sequencing, next generation sequencing, and look to see which of these genes are mutated. And if there are certain mutations, for example, in a patient with newly diagnosed acute myeloid leukemia who is a fit patient to receive intensive chemotherapy, we know that if we give a targeted treatment to that patient, if they have a FLT3, also known as FLT3 mutation, in that particular gene, if we give a targeted therapy, a pill drug called midostaurin or called quizartinib, in addition to the general chemo that we would give to everybody, adding that targeted therapy for that FLT3, that FLT3 mutation, actually can help the patient to be more likely to achieve remission, be more likely to be cured, you know, of that disease. And so that's a very important thing to know, whether or not there's a mutation, you know, in that gene. There are also some other genes that are important in particular. So if they're mutated, like, for example, the IDH1, isocitrate dehydrogenase 1 or IDH2 genes, if the patient's leukemia has responded and then, you know, it comes back later, there are some specific pill drugs, targeted therapies that we can use to target those particular genetic abnormalities. There's also even a newer drug that's called revumenib, and that targets a particular protein called menin, and that menin protein is very important in patients who have a genetic abnormality of, it gets all these letters and numbers. This is called KMT2A. And so I think it becomes overwhelming for a patient to try to remember all these, you know, letters and numbers and all of these is complexity. That's why we, of course, you know, do all this training to learn all of this. But I think the key is to have this conversation with your doctor and your healthcare providers. You know, what are the specific features of my cancer? Is there an option for a targeted therapy? Are there specific genetic mutations that you could identify that would mean that there could be a pill drug that you could add, a targeted therapy that could make help me to respond, you know, better? So those are just some of the examples that I wanted to talk about today. I think I also wanted to talk a bit about, you know, again, I was asked to talk about the role of telemedicine, which I think is very, very important because it enables us to broaden our reach to folks, you know, who are farther away from our centers. I think making sure that you have these conversations with the physician on telemedicine, making sure they have all the records they need to be able to give the best recommendations, and then asking them, you know, would it be helpful to see me in person also? And then I think I want to end really by, you know, highlighting the importance of clinical trials. Clinical trials are really absolutely critical for us to give the best treatments to all of our patients. That's how we make progress. I think from a patient perspective, I would think of it as, you know, potentially gaining access to what we think is the state-of-the-art treatment, you know, for a particular patient. We are learning, of course, by definition in the trial, you know, how well that particular treatment works. But I think it's very important to ask, you know, is there a clinical trial that might work better? And that's actually particularly important in the context of precision medicine and targeted therapy. So, for example, a lot of these newer treatments in leukemia and other cancers were able to be identified, you know, in terms of the biology, but really the way they're shown to be effective in patients is that patients are enrolled in clinical trials, if they're found of a particular feature, and then that targeted therapy is what we'll use to try to see if it works better in that particular patient. That's what leads to, you know, progress and being able to really tailor our treatments for our patients. So I really wanted to just, again, close by highlighting the importance of talking to your doctor about, is there a clinical trial that could give me the best specific treatment for my cancer?
Excellent. This is an excellent presentation, Dr. Goldberg, and I really want to thank you for this really stellar presentation and on leukemia and also about telehealth telemedicine appointments. And I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A as well, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Jennifer Marks. And Jennifer Marks is an instructor in medicine, Harvard Medical School, affiliate staff, Brigham and Women's Hospital, medical oncologist, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Lowe Center for Thoracic Oncology, And Dr. Marks will be addressing the role of precision medicine in deciding the treatment for lung cancer and how precision medicine contributes to treatment options and quality of life. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Marks.
Thank you so much, Dr. Mesler, and Cancer Care for inviting me to speak with you this afternoon. So from my perspective, you're going to hear a lot of the same topics regarding precision medicine, and but I'll be taking it from the scope of my practice in lung cancer specifically. So precision medicine, sometimes called personalized medicine, is an approach where we tailor treatment to the unique biology or biological features of both you and your tumor. And this, as it relates to lung cancer, we look at several specific characteristics, such as markers called biomarkers. And these include somatic mutations, which is the genetic makeup, not something that is hereditary that can be passed down to somatic mutations, which are genetic mutations that are inherent to your actual tumor. So in cancer cells, for lung cancer specifically, we look at EGFR, ALK, ROS1, and something called KRAS. And there are nearly 9 mutations that we have targeted therapies for. Protein expression is another marker that can help us identify immunotherapy that might be more effective in patients, and the marker that we use is called PD-L1. Another marker is called tumor mutational burden, and this, among other genomic signatures, are features that we look at both on blood tests and as well as in tumor biopsies. And these can help to identify which treatments might be more effective or carry side effects associated with certain treatments. So how do we test for these biomarkers? Well, to really harness this precision medicine approach in lung cancer, the first step is really comprehensive molecular testing. And so there's really 2 main avenues for biomarker testing in this space, that being tissue biopsy, where there is a small sample of tumor that's analyzed, and we can perform what's called immunohistochemistry, looking for the protein expression of one of these biomarkers, in this instance, PD-L1. The other often utilized marker, where we get a larger panel or even hundreds of genes at once, is through a broad-based testing approach called next-generation sequencing. The other, the way the field has also changed is that we now have something called liquid biopsies, or where we look at circulating tumor DNA that's been released into the bloodstream, where we can help to identify some of these through a blood test or a blood draw, monitor some of these changes over time, and or identify similar biomarkers aforementioned rather quickly. The other aspects of precision medicine, of course, as it relates to lung cancer, are targeted therapies. That's the main focus at the beginning of seeing a patient with advanced lung cancer in clinic is really identifying whether the patient in front of me has one of these oncologic-driven mutations or oncologic-driven targets, where we have inhibitors such as EGFR inhibitors or osimertinib, or ALK inhibitors such as alectinib or lorlatinib. These help to our patients to respond very quickly to treatment should a marker be identified, and it can gain control of the tumor rather quickly, but also some of these markers have good penetrance into the brain reducing the risk of brain metastases in a lot of these settings. These drugs have really revolutionized outcomes for patients with lung cancer and really have changed the general treatment paradigm for our patients. For patients who don't have an identified targetable mutation, just because it's not targetable today doesn't mean it won't be targetable tomorrow. So it's important to look, because if you never look, you don't know. And we often turn in this case, however, as a standard to immunotherapy. So looking at that PD-L1 expression or that protein expression really helps us depict whether or not an immunotherapy alone as a monotherapy or a single agent treatment may be sufficient to treat the patient in front of us, or if that marker is negative or only positive a little bit on the order of 1 to 49%, often we'll use a combination of immunotherapy in addition to chemotherapy as a strategy to improve overall survival and for better tolerability compared to chemotherapy alone. This also gives us long durable responses compared to other how we formerly used to treat lung cancer. Improving quality of life is also important when it comes to precision medicine. It's not just about prolonging life, but preserving the quality of life. And while we have these great agents, it goes without saying that while we try to minimize the side effects that can be associated with our targeted therapies, this alone is not something, there are still side effects associated with targeted drugs. However, the goal is to create better and better drugs to spare healthy cells, leading to less side effects, hair loss, like you would see with a chemotherapy. Of course, a lot of these are more convenient in that they're orally administered as pills that you take home, that reduce some of the time toxicity of clinic and spending those visits in clinic waiting for infusions and more control of the cancer cell. We also are able to get rapid shrinkage of these tumors that can help relieve pain and shortness of breath more quickly and more effectively with our targeted therapies as well. So it's important as the patient to ensure that comprehensive biomarker testing is completed. So I'd encourage you to advocate if this has not been done, as this should be covered for all patients with lung cancer during the course of their treatment. It's important to ensure everyone has broad-based next-generation testing or next generation sequencing testing to look for these smaller fusions and smaller mutations, as well as PD-L1 testing. And of course, some of this information can help inform the next steps in treatment should you need them later down the line. We often will use some of this testing we will often re-biopsy if, you know, we need more information regarding the molecular subtype so that we can provide the most effective treatment for our patients. And clinical trials, of course, always bring in these layered targeted drugs that are now being combined with different agents in order to hopefully lead to better responses and more tolerable treatments for patients who need a different therapy. So looking ahead, you know, research is ongoing. We're exploring these new targets. There's next generation drugs or better second and third generation inhibitors from our 9+ targeted therapies in the lung cancer space. And these combination strategies continue to change and help keep a step ahead in terms of resistance mechanisms. So the future is bright. Even more individualized therapies are coming with the potential for fewer side effects and better outcome. We hope to improve survival, but also to sustain your quality of life as we're picking a treatment strategy. So thank you very much for your attention and your time, and I welcome any questions you may have at the Q&A session. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Marks. That was just a wonderful presentation, quite stellar, and actually with lots of information in it for people with lung cancer, and also identifying for people all of the new treatments that are there and being developed, and of course the role of clinical trials. So thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well, so thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Jesse Cox. And Dr. Cox is UNMC Pathology Residency Program Director, James Linder, MD Residency Director, Distinguished Professorship Chair, Director, Tissue Typing HLA Laboratory, Nebraska Medicine, Director, Molecular Forensics Laboratory, UNMC, Medical Director, Nebraska Public Service Laboratory, UNMC, Medical Director, Boys Town National Research Hospital, Omaha, Nebraska, Associate Director, Molecular Diagnostics Laboratory, Nebraska Medicine, Associate Professor, Department of Pathology and Microbiology, University of Nebraska Medical Center. And Dr. Cox will be addressing the role of the pathologist and open notes, asking your healthcare team and pathologist to help you understand open notes. It's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Cox.
Well, thank you very much for that introduction. I don't think you needed to go through that whole list, but just in short, so I am a pathologist at the University of Nebraska in Omaha, Nebraska. And so the role of the pathologist kind of sits at the center of a lot of the things that my colleagues have talked about. So at the heart, pathologists are physicians who are charged with actually rendering a proper diagnosis for a patient. So if you have a mass or a tumor, or you have a really high white blood cell counts, the pathologist is the one who's actually looking at the tissues, looking at the cells underneath the microscope to provide a specific diagnosis for whatever the disease process happens to be. As some of my other colleagues alluded to, we do a lot of what we call ancillary testing. So these are additional kind of studies that we perform on different tumors, again, to try to classify and get a better understanding of the biology that's kind of driving a tumor. On the anatomic pathology side, one of the things that we'll do is something called immunoperoxidase stains. And this is a technique where we're trying to characterize and figure out what types of proteins different cells or tumors are expressing. That can be really useful for a number of different reasons. So it can be useful in classifying where the tumor is originating from. It can also be really, really useful in informing potential routes of treatment. So as others have alluded to, there are things like PD-L1, which indicates that your immune system is trying to get at the tumor, but it's kind of getting blocked by the tumor cells. And so there are kind of those immune checkpoint inhibitors to interfere with that type of process. And then we can also look at other potential proteins on cell surfaces, again, to indicate that one drug may be more effective than, say, another drug. So if you do not see a particular protein, then we don't even need to consider this class of drug type. Or if we do see that particular protein present, maybe that opens up more options for patients. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to ensure that people are getting effective treatments without having to endure side effects and things like that. On the molecular side, and so a lot of comments have been made about what's called next generation sequencing and molecular studies and looking for mutations and things like that. So the molecular pathologist is kind of charged with actually interrogating and looking at all of the genetic changes that may have occurred within a given cancer. And so, again, as we kind of alluded to, each particular person's kind of cancer process is unique, and so we use a lot of tests and a lot of tools to try to figure out what things might be driving that cancer, what things might be kind of spurring its growth, and what are some potential mechanisms can we find or identify that may be contributing to potential resistance. when we go through and are looking at these different mutations, we're trying to see the raw genetic code that's in that tumor, and we're comparing it against kind of a reference sequence, looking for changes which could be characteristic or druggable. And keep in mind, there's a number of already FDA-approved type of therapies, depending on a particular mutation present within a tumor population. But as the technology is advanced, we're looking at more and more real estate, if you will, so more and more genes in a given tumor sample. And so oftentimes you'll see, if you're looking at your molecular pathology reports, you'll see a number of different variants or potential changes that could be eligible for things like clinical trials. And so these kind of approaches both apply to solid tumors, so things like lung cancer, GI cancer, so colorectal tumors, things like that, as well as the kind of bloodborne cancers, things like the leukemia or the myelodysplastic syndrome. So a lot of the techniques that are used can apply to more or less both kind of major kind of cancer types. All of this information, of course, gets written up and summarized into reports. And so with recent legislation, all of these reports are freely available to you as the patient. And so in these reports, there's a lot of technical information and a lot of kind of jargon, maybe confusing terms, things like that. One of the things I always advocate for is, as a patient, if you have questions, of course you have access to your oncologists and your primary care physician and those types of individuals. But if you have specific questions, pathologists are physicians. You are more than welcome to reach out to us and to reach out and contact us and ask us questions about what does this finding mean for my tumor? What does that finding mean for my particular case? And so I encourage all patients, if you have any questions about what the different documentation or different kind of staging information that's provided in our reports means, please reach out to us. Like I said, we enjoy talking to patients, and we love informing and kind of educating folks, so that way they can better understand, you know, the kind of the situation that they're enduring. I think with that, that more or less summarizes kind of the role of the pathologist, and I'm happy to take any questions in the Q&A section. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Cox. That was really a stellar presentation, and really helping people to understand more fully the role of the pathologist, and also that the pathologists are very accessible to patients. So, and of course, understanding open notes as well. So thank you so much. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And I'm just going to say a few words now about cancer care services. So Cancer Care is a national organization, and we provide free programs and services to people throughout the country. We do have a Hope Line for people in the United States. They can call 800-813-4673. And an oncology social worker will answer the phone. There's no wait time, so they can and ask a question. They may want to join an online support group, or they may wish to have help with transportation for treatment or practical and financial assistance, or take advantage of our copay assistance program. We also have a website, www.cancercare.org. And again, you'll be able to access all the programs that we offer, both the some of the services I mentioned, and plus a whole range of other services and online support groups that we offer for a wide range of people, including just people living with cancer of any type, people, caregivers, young adults, older adults, middle-aged adults, specific types of cancer, LGBTQ community. So we do offer services to everyone you can think of, partners, spouses. So really just all types of online support groups as well. So again, you can either call our Hope Line or you can visit our website for more detailed information and just sign up for one of our online support groups. And now we're going to move right on to the Q&A. So I'm going to ask Audra to explain to you how to queue up and ask online questions. Audra?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
Okay, so quite a few questions here, so let me start. So I'll give this question to Dr. Saltz. Should a patient with advanced breast cancer have a tissue biopsy, liquid biopsy, or both to guide treatment?
So let me start by saying the world is very subspecialized in cancer care, and I'm not a breast cancer doctor. In general, for management of patients, it's desirable to have tissue, but often a liquid biopsy or blood test looking for the tumor DNA that's circulating in the blood can be adequate. If somebody has already had biopsies, I'm frequently comfortable with using the blood test, and if that provides adequate information, that's fine. There are some scenarios where either tumor doesn't shed well into the blood and you don't get much information, or otherwise certain aspects are better seen on the tissue. But I'm afraid that I'm going to have to refer the specifics of that kind of question on breast cancer to somebody that treats that disease.
Thank you so much, and thanks for giving some guidelines here. Thank you very much. Thank you. So this is a question. Why is it so hard to get an oncologist to order a circulating tumor cell test, such as Tempus, which for stage 3 and 4, for stage 3 and not 4? So a question for Dr. Goldberg.
Well, stage 3, I think you're asking.
Go ahead.
I don't think there's stage 3 leukemia, so something's not fitting there.
Right. I think this is a better question for my cell tumor, Dr.
Oh,
Marks.
Oh, sorry. Exactly. Dr. Marks, thank you. Thanks for your help. Thank you, Dr. Marks.
Yeah. So I will say, unfortunately, depending on the vendor sometimes that you are that the institution that you're receiving your care at works with, some of them don't cover or your insurance will not pay for a circulating tumor test in addition to doing the full molecular testing on the tissue. Now, the next generation sequencing on the tissue is the standard of care. It is sometimes available for a vendor to do it as early as stage 2, but it is very nebulous whether or not certain vendors will pay for or some will eat the cost if your insurance denies the coverage. But as was mentioned before, not all solid tumors shed. I want to say for breast cancer specifically, they do a ctDNA is available, but only in the advanced, like the metastatic setting or the very advanced stage 4 setting, after previous lines in hormone sensitive or the hormone driven breast cancers. But back to lung cancer specifically, some will cover it and some won't. It can get us an answer quickly within like within 8 days of sending off that test. But some of the other more comprehensive testing takes about 3 weeks to come back. And if the ctDNA is negative or that blood test is negative, we still will rely on the tissue nonetheless.
If I could take the question from a colorectal mm-hmm. point of view, because mm-hmm. there I think it may be the situation where perhaps a doctor is declining to order it. There are two good reasons not to order it in stage 3 colorectal cancer. If you're talking about ordering it for understanding the mutational analysis of the tumor, it wouldn't be relevant in stage 3 because there are no clinical decisions that would be made on any information we might get. The molecular profiling is really only used in clinical medicine in stage 4 or metastatic disease. Secondarily, you wouldn't expect circulating tumor DNA after removal of stage 3 disease because the tumor is out. Now, what you may be referring to is another use of circulating tumor DNA, which is to try to identify recurrence of the disease sooner than you might otherwise find it by routine surveillance. And that's a different topic, but the short answer to a complicated question is, while this has become very commercially pushed forward and advertised on the internet, there really are no clinical decisions that should be made on these circulating tumor DNAs. They're not recommended currently by any of the major guidelines for use in monitoring stage 3. And so I would agree with a doctor that doesn't do that. It's not really something that is useful in terms of making care better for the patient. So you have to be careful, because there's a lot of information out there, especially on the internet. It's information, it's misinformation and disinformation, and it's sometimes very hard to tell the difference. So it's important to be communicating with your doctor. I would hope and expect that in all cases, the doctor's working in your best interest. And so if a doctor is telling you that a test isn't indicated and you're not comfortable with that answer, it's worth understanding and asking for further discussion as to why it's not indicated. The basic answer would be if it's not going to help make decisions that will help in guiding your care.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And a question for Dr. Cox. How long does it typically take to receive genetic biomarker testing results? Can this delay treatment?
Typically, the industry standard for most molecular testing is a turnaround time of 10 business days from when that sample is received by the laboratory. At a lot of hospital laboratories, we have our own kind of local molecular lab, and so our turnaround times are actually a little bit shorter than that, and so we can kind of get answers back to at least our oncologists a little bit quicker. With regard to impact on therapy and impact on treatment and things like that, I would have to defer to my oncology colleagues. That is an area that I'm not super familiar with, but I know, let's say that a patient's had a major resection or something of that nature. Oftentimes, patients are kind of healing in that initial kind of post-surgical time. And so I don't know that, you know, any major treatment decisions are made like right out of the gate, you know, kind of after a diagnosis has been established. So, but again, I would for that question, I would defer to my clinical colleagues.
I can speak to it a little bit from a leukemia perspective, because this comes up a lot, you know, for a patient with a newly diagnosed acute myeloid leukemia. It's fair to say, of course, that we don't want to wait forever on treatment for that patient, because things do progress, but it has been looked at, you know, is there any harm to delaying, for example, even a week, hopefully less than that, to try to make sure we're tailoring our treatment to that particular person's leukemia. It doesn't seem to be harmful, and it may even be helpful. One of the great examples of this, again, to plug clinical trials, there's a National Cancer Institute-supported clinical trial called MyeloMatch, which is open now in over 100 centers around the country, and that's really a biomarker-driven trial where we're trying to, again, really tailor the treatment for newly diagnosed acute myeloid leukemia to that particular person's leukemia subtype, those particular mutations. And so there's a centralized process where that tissue is sent to specific labs, and we get answers back within 72 hours for the chromosomes and the next generation sequencing, because there's been a lot of work that's gone into trying to really turn that around quickly. So again, it's a plug for I think the importance of clinical trials, and I think it's a good important question for your doctor with your particular tumor type. But at least in acute myeloid leukemia, which is an aggressive, fast-moving cancer, it is okay to wait a short amount of time to give you the best treatment.
Yeah, and then I will kind of tack on to that, at least at our institution. So some of these kind of critical clinical decision points in the context of AML, so something called a FLT3 ITD or internal tandem duplication, NPM1 testing, there's a protein called IDH1 and a kind of a sister protein called IDH2 that can be mutated. Those types of tests, a lot of molecular laboratories will do alternative testing modalities to actually get oncologists answers a lot faster. So kind of like random access tests that aren't necessarily next-gen sequencing, but we can provide answers a lot faster for those kind of critical decision points. So,
Excellent. Thank you so much. And this question for Dr. Cox. So the building block of precision medicine is tumor genomic profiling. Hence, do not you think that it should be implemented regardless of the cancer diagnosis for its advancement of that cancer type?
Yeah, so I will say at our institution that my impression is that almost every new cancer diagnosis we're doing some sort of molecular testing on. So for instance, if there's a, let's say somebody goes in for a colonoscopy, the endoscopist sees what's concerning for a cancer, and then when the pathologist looks at it under the microscope, they say, yes, that is in fact an invasive adenocarcinoma. We'll go on and start doing the workup for molecular profiling, molecular testing, even on that biopsy sample. A lot of the really comprehensive or larger gene panels, so I know somebody had mentioned like Tempus before, but Foundation Medicine, Caris, those are kind of other large reference laboratory providers for this type of testing. Oftentimes the reason why a lot of this more advanced testing isn't performed is just because we need a fair amount of tissue to actually do these like large multi-gene panels on. And so, you know, on an initial diagnosis or an initial biopsy, there may not be enough tissue to do that full-on comprehensive testing. And so that's where, you know, patients may go back for an additional biopsy, or that's where you start looking at some of these other kind of liquid biopsy types of modalities to start getting a handle on what are the unique characteristics kind of driving this tumor process. So hopefully that helps answer some of the questions.
And the question for Dr. Cox, has artificial intelligence, AI, been discussed in precision medicine? If so, how would this impact future practice?
At this point in time, there's nothing going on, at least clinically. So any application of AI technologies would still be in kind of a research type of realm. There's been a lot of interest in automating some of the more manual or tedious processes of our practice. So we've talked a lot about PD-L1 kind of staining intensity, HER2 staining, those types of things. A lot of that assessment of those kind of stain intensities is a very manual process where a pathologist has to count a certain number of cells, and that takes a lot of time and those types of things. So there's been a lot of interest in using AI tools to help automate that type of process. But by and large, the field is still highly reliant upon kind of experts in the field basically assessing, you know, tissues under the microscope.
Awesome, thank you. And this will be the last question, which I'm going to actually pose to everybody. Is there a, as comes from one of our participants, is there a patient education resource for, in quotations, questions to ask your doctor about precision medicine? Does anyone know of such a resource for patients? If
longevity.
Not, we'll try to find one.
Yeah, Longevity has a really great patient packet about biomarkers that I would highly recommend downloading off of their website. It should be free. I think they also have other ones tailored to certain disease types as well, or it's specific to a disease type. GRACE is also another good resource for patients. It's an acronym, and I apologize. I'm blanking on all of what it stands for, but they also have a lot of resources for patients regarding precision medicine and what to ask your physician about.
I'd also add that National Cancer Care Network, or NCCN, has specific publications that are tailored for patients, so they're written in standard understandable English rather than in technical jargon. And they are very useful, I think, to a lot of people in helping to explain treatment options, precision and otherwise.
Excellent. Anyone else? Okay. This has been an amazing program today, I have to say. We've done programs on precision medicine before, but I have to say the questions have been fantastic. Our speakers have been phenomenal. And it's just been a great program. I'm going to ask each of our speakers to just provide a takeaway from today's program. So I'll start with Dr. Saltz, if he could begin, just to give people just a minute takeaway from the program today, what you'd like people to take away from today's program.
Well, very simply, that precision medicine is basically modern oncology. It's where we are today, that we want to understand as much about the biology of the particular cancer that is threatening our patients so that we can understand the most effective way to approach it. And if it's an issue that you don't feel that you have enough understanding in your own particular case, then it's important to discuss it with your oncologist to get a better understanding of what's going on.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Goldberg.
Yeah, I would agree. I agree with all of my colleagues. I just wanted to also mention the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society specifically is an excellent resource for patients who have various leukemias and blood cancers. They have a specific panel for patients on biomarker testing for cancer treatment, which includes a lot of what we've talked about today. I agree in terms of the takeaway. This is, you know, state-of-the-art modern medicine and oncology. And it's really tailoring our treatments for you, making sure we're giving each and every patient, you know, the best possible treatment, taking into account, you know, all factors, including the patient in front of us, you know, what our treatments are and what the specific features of the disease are, so we can give you the best treatments. And I would echo also the importance of communication. And, you know, your doctors should be accessible to you if you have questions. You know, sit down that visit and say, you know, hey, here are the questions that I have. And have that list of questions, and then you can go through, and that's always just really important to be able to make sure that you can ask all the questions and that they're adequately addressed.
Excellent. And Dr. Marks?
I would say my takeaway is that, you know, personalized treatment or the really precision medicine-focused treatment in lung cancer has the patient at the forefront, and that should be a conversation with your doctor, and the patient needs to be actively involved in that conversation in picking the treatment choices. While we do use all of this targeted testing to focus our treatment and decide between treatments, you know, the patient is part of this decision, and it has to work for your lifestyle. So that's something also to bring up with your doctor. I would say just because something is not targetable again today doesn't mean it won't be targetable in the future. And so this is how the field moves forward and how we are able to provide additional treatments to our patients. So everyone, in my opinion, should get next-generation sequencing testing for lung cancer especially in order to bring all of this information to the forefront and really understand the biology of these tumors as they relate to cancer care.
Oh, excellent. Thank you so much. And Dr. Cox?
Yeah, and so again, just to echo what all my colleagues have said. So again, you know, the role of the pathologist is to try to examine the biology behind and driving the cancer process, and to kind of push forward the development of these new tests and new kind of testing modalities to help answer some of these unknown questions. And as I kind of mentioned during my little session, you know, if you have questions about the reports that you're seeing, feel free to reach out to the pathologist. We love communicating. We love serving as educators, both for our clinical colleagues as well as for patients. So do not hesitate to reach out to the person who signed off on your pathology report or your molecular pathology report if you have questions. So,
thank you. I just want to thank our speakers. You've really been phenomenal. And you also, all the references that you gave, we will be providing a SurveyMonkey in about a week from this program date. And the SurveyMonkey will include an evaluation of the program itself, but also we will also include all of resources that our speakers so generously gave, and we'll add some too, perhaps that weren't mentioned. And certainly there were some that our speakers mentioned during the takeaways that we'll include as well. And we want to be sure that you're well armed with all the information that you need. Also, some of you did ask about is there a replay of this? And yes, this program does occur in real time, like today, but it does also occur as a podcast. It takes about 10 days for the podcast to go up on our website, on the Cancer Care website, and you'll all be getting notice of that as well, and you'll be able to listen to it podcast is up 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for at least a year. So you'll be able to hear the program. Sometimes it's up longer than that. So also, I just want to comment on, before we just end the call, for those of you who had a chance to ask a question, you've learned a lot today. So go back to your community healthcare team and ask them the same question. And for those of you who are in queue to ask a question, please do ask, ask your question of your healthcare team, and because you've learned a lot. And again, you'll be able to understand perhaps more of what they say, and you'll be able to ask more informed questions. Also, we've learned that many of you have no difficulty reaching your healthcare team during the day, but it seems that nighttime, weekends, and holidays are challenging at times. You don't know who to call or what to do. So please ask your healthcare team who you call weekends, evenings, and holidays. Also, we don't want anyone to leave this program feeling that you're alone. We want you to now feel that you're part of a community of support, and we're going to send you a lot of resources that our speakers mentioned during the program that you'll be able to access and have with them at your fingertips. There are some also resources that provide, you can call them 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, whatever number of days there are in a year. And they are open, so you'll be able to actually ask questions there as well. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.